for his mouth city. God sent the United States in his honorable court.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for argument this morning is United States against Flashburger. Mr. Weiss.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is David Weiss, and I'm appearing here on behalf of the respondent appellant, Mr. Thomas Flashburger. We're here today because of two central issues. Number one, there is no evidence in this case to demonstrate that Mr. Flashburger had the requisite intent to defraud anyone. And number two, Mr. Flashburger's sentence violated his Sixth Amendment rights under the recent case decided by the United States Supreme Court in Booker. I want to just spend a couple of minutes on the first point, and then I'll go ahead and address the Booker matter, which may be of great interest to the court. Number one, the evidence demonstrates that Mr. Flashburger had no knowledge at all that the student numbers, as reported, were incorrect. And because he had no knowledge that those student numbers were incorrect, he therefore could not have the requisite intent to defraud.
I wonder why that is so. The prosecutor says, and the indictment says, that one of the fraudulent certifications was that the money was used to provide those services that are authorized for Perkins grants. And the government's claim is that the consortium never, ever provided those services to anyone, and yet Flashburger certified that that's how the money was used. Now, that surely is a fraud. Your brief discusses only the number of students question and not the use of money question.
Let me address your question in two parts, if I may. First, with regard to Mr. Flashburger's certification, the government would have us believe that simply because Mr. Flashburger certified not only that the numbers of students were correct, but also admittedly that the services were provided, that simply in and of itself is enough to convict Mr. Flashburger and indicate that he's got the requisite intent. That is simply not so.
Why not? That's what the certification is for. This thing is being certified, right? It's not, this is somebody's signature, but he doesn't have a clue what he's certifying. That's what a certification is. It says, I certify this after an investigation that would allow a reasonable man to do it. There are two options, it seems to me. One is he actually knew his certification was false, and the other is he signed not caring whether his certification was false. And, of course, they're both forms of intent. One is the direct intent, and the other is the ostrich version. And they're both criminally culpable.
I would respectfully submit that there's a third option, and that is that what the government's really arguing here is maybe that Mr. Flashburger should have known or possibly could have known that the services weren't provided. But that's simply not insufficient amount of requisite intent here. It's not that he deliberately ignored any evidence that the services were not provided. There's no testimony that Mr. Flashburger somehow was informed.
What is the evidence that would permit a jury to conclude that a reasonable person in Flashburger's position would have believed that services were being provided?
Well, first of all, I think there is some, admittedly, there is that this may only relate to a relatively small amount of money, but there is some evidence in the record that some of that money, at least, was spent legitimately. Secondly, even the indictment itself doesn't purport to allege that the purported scheme here began as early as 1994.
Now, that's a different question. Let's just look at the years of conviction, 99, 2000, 2001. What was the evidence in the record that would have permitted a reasonable jury to conclude that a reasonable person would have thought that services were being provided?
I don't think, with all due respect, Your Honor, that was Flashburger's burden.
All right. Well, then your answer is there was none.
I will admit that there was a relatively small number, yes. There's not the affirmative evidence in the record that services were provided with that exception. That's correct, Your Honor. And to continue, If the government wants to make the claim that Mr. Flassberger should have known or something to that effect, and you made reference to the ostrich instruction.
Look, the argument is not that he should have known. It's that he affirmatively certified the truth of the statement, services are being provided. Right? That's the burden of the claim, and the fact that he affirmatively certified the truth of that proposition without, so far as this record shows, any evidence that would have permitted him to believe it was true is the gist of the crime.
Again, I would respectfully submit that the certification alone is insufficient. To suggest that anybody who signs a certification of that sort is automatically criminally liable just simply because that certification proves to be false starts to approach...
But how do you approach your taxes? When you sign your tax return and certify the correctness of them, do you take the position that you have no duty whatsoever to inquire into whether any of the things you have just certified is true? We have a lot of people in federal prison for tax evasion who have taken that position.
In that particular instance, Your Honor, if you certify that the taxes are true, that doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to federal prison on the basis of tax evasion or that you've intended to defraud something simply because that...
It will not be a sufficient response in a tax prosecution to say that the taxpayer who filed and signed the return had no duty whatsoever to inquire into whether the statements on the return were true.
I'm not suggesting that that's the case, Your Honor, but what I am suggesting is that if that taxpayer did not affirmatively know that those numbers upon which the taxes were based were incorrect, then simply certifying that that's what the tax return was is insufficient.
You might want to move to sentencing. Before you start discussing Booker, you might want to discuss whether the guideline calculations were correct.
The guideline calculations, assuming for the moment that the Judge Shabazz's factual findings at the district court level were correct, which we do not believe they were, then technically speaking, as a matter of just looking it up on the chart, yes.
Look, here's what I'm worried about, and it's something you have alluded to a couple of times, although perhaps not paid enough attention. The relevant conduct calculation included all of the Perkins grants from 1984 to current. Was there any finding by the district court that the whole thing from 1984 to current was part of a common scheme or plan? Because otherwise, under the guidelines, only 99 to 2001 would count.
At sentencing, I think, Your Honor, the Judge Shabazz found that the loss in this case was approximately $900,000. I don't recall.
I asked a concrete question about whether there was a finding that all of the years were part of a common scheme or plan. That is the guideline question.
I have to confess, Your Honor, that I don't recall that he made that finding in the my reading of the transcript. I could be wrong, to be honest with you, but I don't recollect that he made that specific finding.
But otherwise, the only things that count are the years of conviction.
And I think that's what we've argued from the beginning, Your Honor.
No, it's not what you've argued from the beginning. Unfortunately, what you've argued from the beginning is that the amount should be reduced to reflect the number of students your client thought was in. But since the whole thing can be deemed a fraud, the whole amount could be included. The question I'm asking is for what years, not for how many students.
Well, at a maximum, Your Honor, the years that should be considered are the years from the 1999 through 2001, which reflect the 3 years that reflect each of the three counts of the mail fraud indictment itself. Anything that goes beyond that, I would submit, is beyond not only the indictment but the evidence itself in this particular matter. And as such, I think violates the judge's findings violate the standard that we now know exists in Booker, and it constitutes plain error in this matter, which I'd like to take just a few moments to address. The plain error standard consists basically of four parts. The first two parts are that there's an error and that the error is plain. Those two parts the government concedes are met here. So we'd like to focus on part number three, which is whether or not the error in this particular matter affected Mr. Flassberger's substantial rights. We submit that it did, and for a number of different reasons. First of all, Yesterday afternoon, we received some additional material from the government, which I'm sure they will argue supports their proposition. But we submit that it actually supports ours. First of all, they make reference to the fact that Judge Shabazz declined to enter a downwardly sentence Mr. Flashburger. But the reason he did so, Your Honor, is because he felt that he was constrained by the mandatory nature of the sentencing guidelines. In fact, I'm quoting from the sentencing transcript itself, Judge Shabazz, after acknowledging that there's an opportunity for a downward departure, says, it has difficulty, and I think there he means the court, and it has difficulty in determining not the creativity that they have in the Northern District of Illinois as to what the downward departure should be, and the court believes that the law should be followed. The law that the court...
Counsel, what would the sentencing range have been if only 1999 to 2001 had been included in the loss calculation?
I believe that results in a reduction of Mr. Flashburger's sentence in approximately 6 to 8 months, sir. So what Judge Shabazz is indicating there is he feels constrained by the mandatory nature of the guidelines. So there is a substantial there is an effect on Mr. Flashburger's substantial rights. If Mr. Flashburger's sentence...
What do you think is the best way to tell whether the sentence would have been different in the post-Booker world?
Well, in the post-Booker world, I think you still, as Booker indicates, you know, ordinary principles of the... of plain error still applying, so I would refer to Dominguez and Benitez, in which the standard for the third prong is whether or not is that the defendant must satisfy the reviewing court in light of all of the evidence that the probability of a different result is sufficient to undermine confidence
in
the outcome.
And how do we know that?
Well, in this particular instance, we know that for a couple of different
X-ray
reasons.
X-ray vision into the district judge's mind.
No, in this particular case, I don't think we
How
have
about
to.
How if we bring him in and strap him in a chair and administer a polygraph?
As amusing as that might be, I don't think that's necessary here. Again, Judge Shabazz has indicated that he felt constrained by the guidelines. He also gave Mr. Flashburger a sentence at the bottom range of the sentencing range that Judge Shabazz thought he should have been into. There was a 30 to 37-month range. He sentenced Mr. Flashburger to the bottom of that range. Combined with his view that he was somehow constrained by the mandatory nature of the guidelines, would suggest that had he had the opportunity, he would have departed from that downward and given Mr. Flashburger a reduced sentence. In addition to that, the evidence simply does not support the factual findings that the judge made in this instance regarding the loss of this matter. I see that I'm kind of running short on time, and I'd like to reserve the remaining minutes for rebuttal, if I may.
Certainly, Mr. Weiss.
Thank you.
Mr. Elke.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Stephen Elke. I'm an assistant United States attorney with the Western District of Wisconsin. I was one of the counsel below in this matter. I'd like to briefly touch on the sufficiency of evidence because it was raised and then answer your question, Judge Easterbrook, as best I can in terms of was there a specific finding about the guideline and then move on to Booker. In terms of the sufficiency of the evidence, first of all, as noted in the brief, it's a plain error review. There was more than enough evidence for the jury to convict in this case. He had a number of years involved. The numbers that of students that were misstated in the beginning when they put in for the money is not off by 10 or 15 students. It's off by quite a bit, sometimes as much as double. Mr. Flashburger had to know the services weren't being provided because it's a small area where this is going on. He knows there's no counseling services going on. There was testimony by Norm Kinney and Mike Delgado that they went through many, many, many student files, didn't find anything. And if I could, Your Honor, read just one question, two questions and answers from the record. Question, well, you would agree with me, wouldn't you, sir, and this is to Mr. Flashburger, that when the consortium puts in a claim for payment under Perkins Grant, you're informing the state that you've provided the services that the Perkins Grant requires, right? Answer, and I was also informing the college, and the college approved it. Question, right. So when you send, for example, this document in, document number 11, that is an indication that to the state these services have been provided, a check should be cut. Answer, technically correct. And that's at record 51. Page 57. So he himself admitted he knew that that's what he was doing when he submitted those.
Let's go to the sentencing questions. And there, I at least have a similar question for the sentences for both the conviction and the restitution. which is what are the years 1994 through 1997 doing in these calculations? It's separate questions, actually. For restitution, under the Restitution Act, the restitution is limited to the crime of conviction. It can't include anything other than the crime of conviction. That's not only what the statute says, it's what the Supreme Court held in Hughey. But here, the inclusion of years, the only crimes of conviction are 1999 to 2001. So I don't understand what 1984 through 1998 are doing in the restitution order.
Well, I believe, Your Honor, in the PSR at paragraph 17 and 18 and under guideline 1B1.3 paren A paren 2, it notes that you were to include all acts and omissions. And I agree with you that the mail fraud counts of conviction were for those 3 years.
There are separate questions here. The guideline you're referring to is going to be important to the loss calculation for purposes of the penal sentence. The restitution question is not governed by the guidelines at all. It's governed by the mandatory victim, etc., restitution statute and the Supreme Court's decision in Hughey, which says that restitution is limited to the count of conviction, not to the whole scheme, not to all losses, to the count of conviction. So my question is, how can restitution for the years 1994 to 1998 be justified given the terms of the statute and the Supreme Court's holding in Hughey?
I understand your question, Your Honor. I apologize. I don't have a precise answer for you because that was not at all addressed in any of the briefs, and so I don't have an answer for you. But
I don't think there is an answer. So it would have been nice if you had an answer, but this appears to be a plain error. Now let's pass on to the imprisonment, where, as you say, under the guideline, the critical question is, what is the common scheme or plan? Did the district judge make a finding that 1994 through 2001 was all a common scheme or plan?
And there, Your Honor, I believe that he did at sentencing, at record 52, page 8. He doesn't use those words, common scheme or plan. He doesn't say 1994, but what he talks about, the court says, for example, at page 8, the court notes that the actions of the defendant did divert the entire amount except the probably about $4,000. And he goes on.
That's not the common scheme or plan finding.
Well, he goes on that same page and says the court determines the defendant failed to exercise adequate supervision and oversight of the activities that were occurring, even though he was supposedly supposed to be supervising the people. So he's talking about.
You know, look, that's just a finding that he's guilty. Doesn't. If you think that's the common scheme or plan finding, we have a serious problem under the guidelines completely preceding any Booker issue. I mean, we've been quite clear that district judges have to make and have supported in the record an express finding when making a relevant conduct calculation that these other acts outside the count of conviction are part of a common scheme or plan. That's the guideline requirement. And if there's no such finding here, we never get to Booker.
I don't believe that the district court used that precise language, Your Honor. What I'm suggesting to you is that he is, in essence, saying the same thing when he's talking about the actions of the defendant over this time period.
No, he's not, in essence, saying the same thing unless he explains why 1994 gets included when the first count of conviction is 1999. It's quite different to say he's culpable and, on the other hand, to say it's all a common scheme or plan.
Well, he does note in the sentencing as well, Your Honor, that there's no evidence, as you asked about, to the contrary, that any of the money was used for an appropriate person, or purpose, rather. So I'm telling you the evidence in the record that would come as close to what you're asking as I can, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be at the sentencing is where it would be found, if anywhere, Your Honor. Because in terms of the Booker analysis, everyone agrees that it's a plain error review and that the first two prongs are met. We do not believe in this case that the third prong can be satisfied by the defendant because he cannot show that he would have received a different sentence. We filed a 28-J letter this morning which contains the Rodriguez decision. And in this case, the court, after coming up with the guideline range, which was 30 to 37 months, specifically declined to depart downward under 2F1.1, saying that he did not feel that the loss amount was grossly disproportionate to the seriousness of the offense in this case.
And was there a motion to depart downward?
Yes, there was a pleading filed ahead of time, and an addendum to the PSR was filed, Your Honor.
What about this case?
Yes, in this case.
In this case?
Yes, there was a motion for a downward departure under that section, and that was specifically addressed by Judge Shabazz at sentencing. He declined to do so, finding that it didn't apply, and then sentenced Mr. Blashberger at the bottom of the range in this matter. So it is the defendant's burden in this matter, we believe, to show that there would have been a different result, and therefore he cannot meet the third prong under the plain error test here, Your Honor. Likewise, if the court should find that there is some reason to find that the third prong was met, we also do not believe that the fourth prong could be met because the process was not corrupted in this matter. Everything that had been done for the last 20 years in terms of sentencing was done here. A PSR was completed. There was a sentencing, right of allocution. Letters were submitted by Mr. Flashberger. He had all the due process that's been afforded to other defendants as long as the guidelines have been in place. So we do not believe the fourth prong would be met here either. If there's no further questions, that's all I would have to say beyond what is in the briefs, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Anything further, Mr. Weiss?
I'd just like to make two very quick points, if I may. First, the government again suggests that somehow that Judge Shabazz refused to enter a downward departure, but I wanted to simply point out again that Judge Shabazz refused to enter a downward departure in this matter because he felt as though he could not, a situation that since Booker has dramatically changed. Secondly, Judge Shabazz didn't make a finding about the scheme extending throughout that entire period because he couldn't. For example, Mr. Flashberger, it was never demonstrated that Mr. Flashberger was in charge of making sure that student services were received. Firmly did not have any ability to access any funds that once they were given to the college. The funds that went to the college went to the business office, and from there it was completely out of Mr. Flashberger's hands. Moreover, Mr. Flashberger was not even involved with grants throughout that entire period. At one point, he was not involved. So in light of all of that, I would respectfully submit this court reverse Mr. Flashberger's sentence because of insufficient evidence of intent, or in the alternative to reverse his sentence on the basis of not only Booker but pre-Booker guidelines regarding sentencing. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. And Mr. Weiss, we want to thank you and your firm for your willingness to accept the appointment in this case and the assistance you've been both to your client and to the judiciary. Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.